Parent Show, sponsored by Raydon Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raydonsolicitors.co.uk.
And welcome to the Parent Show here on Radio Verulam on 92.6 FM, sponsored by Raydon Solicitors. I'm Steve Simpson. Tonight we're going to be bringing you two thought-provoking interviews, both of which are particularly relevant to parents at any time, but are brought into even sharper focus by the effects of the extended lockdown period. Later in the programme, I will be joined by June O'Sullivan. June is the CEO of the London Early Years Foundation, but also a staunch lobbyist to the government on childhood obesity. With the recent announcement of government funding to help tackle the issues through a comprehensive approach, we will be asking June what the causes are and what both governments and parents can do to halt the dramatic increase in childhood obesity. But first, Lydia and Seema met up with Helen Lafferty from our sponsors, Raydon Solicitors, to discuss the disturbing rise in domestic violence in the family environment over recent years.
Hello and welcome to the Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia El-Khoury.
And good evening, everybody. I am Seema Barker and very happy to be with you this evening.
So on tonight's show, we're zoning in particularly on domestic violence and abuse. And we have the best possible guest joining us to speak about the issue. We've got Helen Lafferty, who's a solicitor with Raydon Solicitors, which is a family law firm here in St. Albans. And we're very proud to say a sponsor of the Parents Show. So, Helen, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure, our pleasure. So let's just kick off by asking, I mean, particularly lockdown, COVID, domestic violence is extremely topical. We're seeing it in the news all the time. And we're concerned by what we're hearing, that the situation has actually deteriorated in the last 12 months. But we'd love to know what your experience has been.
Yes, so the statistics do show that there has been an increase in reported cases, very sadly, of domestic abuse and people accessing services for victims of domestic abuse, so helplines. So our experience has been definitely that there has been a catalyst from COVID-19 that has led to lots of people needing support lines and injunctions. Yeah.
And Helen, so does that also, I suppose one of the things that occurred to me is when we're talking about domestic abuse, perhaps the stereotype is a woman living with a violent man. Are we also seeing, have you also seen an increase in more financial, economic abuse as well? Because I think we have to remember that domestic abuse actually is much wider than just violence.
Yes, absolutely. So, lots of people don't realise, and that's one of the real difficulties that we have, that domestic abuse is not just about violence. It's psychological abuse, emotional abuse, financial abuse. And more recently, people have started talking about coercive and controlling behaviour. So all of these things have definitely increased during COVID, increased because of lockdowns, people being inside the home more often. And there's just no escape from it, it seems. So one of the things that we've noticed as well is that financial abuse is more prevalent because people are losing their jobs and because there's furlough, meaning that people are receiving less income than they were. So it's definitely changed the dynamic of domestic abuse, yes.
So have you been involved in more cases of a particular type over the last 12 months? Has there been more injunctions? How is it? Is it different for you as a family lawyer compared to what it was like pre-COVID?
I wouldn't say that it's been different cases have become more prevalent. I think there's always been, unfortunately, a really big problem with domestic abuse. But the fact that there has been no escape from it for children, they haven't been able to go to school, so they've been exposed to it more often. That means that there has just been... there's been a lot of domestic abuse on a daily basis rather than it being spread out. Or before COVID, we had an increase usually around Christmas time because people are at home more or in summer holidays. And now that's just continuing on a daily basis. So it's more that there hasn't been an escape for these victims and for the children.
I hadn't actually thought about that, Helen. So of course it makes sense. There's just been an awful lot of more exposure, and I hadn't thought that children kind of have no get out route. I suppose with them being back at school now, hopefully that'll ease the situation to a certain extent. But Helen, can you tell our listeners, those who mightn't know what a family lawyer can do to support somebody who is in a domestic abuse situation, would you mind telling them what tools are at your disposal and what can victims of abuse use as a tool for who are find themselves in that situation?
Of course. So one of the main things that we do for victims of domestic abuse is seek injunctions. So there's something that's called a non-molestation order. And what that does is provide an order that the perpetrator is not allowed to harass, pester, intimidate or molest the victim. They're not allowed to use or threaten any violence towards the victim. You can even include that they're not allowed to come within 100 metres or a specified distance of the victim's home. And they're not allowed to encourage or instruct anyone else to do those things as well. And those orders can protect children as well. So if the children are subject to the abuse or they've witnessed the abuse, it can protect those. And also there's an occupation order, which is an order that prevents the perpetrator from entering or remaining in the family home. So if you need an order that protects you in the home, then that's something that a family lawyer can help you to obtain.
And does that extend to telephones? That's because I'm about texting, calling, because I'd say even social media, is that a route that's used to abuse as well?
Yes, absolutely. So another thing that we can ask for in a non-molestation order is that the perpetrator can't contact the victim at all through social media, texting, calling or any other means, or instructing or encouraging anyone else to do so. So even if they were stopped from messaging, they can't then ask a friend or somebody else to message the victim on their behalf. And we can work around that in terms of if there's children that need to have contact with the perpetrator, then, you know, it can be contact only in respect of the children. So yes, definitely we can seek injunctions to stop contact between the victim and the perpetrator. Yes.
Can I ask how that would work? For example, if the children needed to be in contact with one of the parents, would it be through an intermediary, or how would it work?
It completely depends on what works best for the parents and what works best for the children. So if there is a high level of conflict and the parents really cannot speak to one another and shouldn't speak to another because it's not in the child's interest, then there can be an injunction that says no contact other than through a person that's been nominated, for example, a grandparent or a friend. Or if there can be a level of dialogue between the parents, that can also be the wording of the order. Or somewhere in between. So we can instruct them just to use certain methods of communication, like email, for example, if we don't want telephone calls happening. So yeah, there's ways around that for individuals to suit their needs and the children's needs in particular.
And following up on that, can the order go so far as to specify, I suppose I'm thinking of different age children, so there might be an older teenager maybe that feels safe seeing one of the parents, but perhaps less so for younger ones?
Yeah, so the other thing that family solicitors can get is a Children Act proceeding. They can start Children Act proceedings, so you can get an order specifically in relation to the children about what time they spend with each parent. So if there were specific needs for different age groups for different children, then that could be put into a specific order saying they will see this child on this day, or they will speak to this child via Skype on this day. And it can be the whole point of that order is that it's in the child's best interest. So it's not about what either parent necessarily want or need or demand. It's about what is right for that child. And absolutely, they can be different things for different parents, for different children, depending on their relationship with the child and their age.
Yeah, that's really helpful, actually, to know that for parents that might be listening, so that the tools available are in for protection for themselves, but also for the children. And obviously, as a family solicitor, you will tease out of somebody that comes to see you what might be necessary, because of course somebody might come to see you feeling very vulnerable, very overwhelmed, and not really know what it is they want, I suppose. Is a lot of skepticism as well, isn't there, I think, about this whole area. And I was reading recently that, you know, about 40% of cases involving children in family courts include allegations of domestic abuse, which is very high. But then the figure was about 22,000 cases for the years 2019 and 2020, which is a phenomenal amount. What do you think? You know, do you think that's true, all of the skepticism about not really being able to help people that are suffering from domestic abuse?
Yeah, we see that a lot. And I think one of the biggest issues with that is that the perpetrator has told the victim that they won't be believed. And the problem is that people come to us and say, this is what's happened to me. And they often don't even realise that that is domestic abuse, particularly financial and psychological and emotional abuse that we spoke about before. People simply think that that is normal because that's what they're used to, and they've been told that no one will listen to them. And absolutely, there is skepticism around it. People have heard horror stories about people not being protected. But I do think that one of the reasons that the statistics are so shockingly high is because people recognise it more now. They recognise these different types of abuse, and the courts are trying to, and solicitors are trying to help victims to get out of that really awful situation that they're in, and to get help. So yes, the statistics are really, really shocking and really sad. And, you know, it happens everywhere. It happens to our neighbours and to our friends, and we don't realise it. But I hope that actually those statistics are proving that we are doing better at recognizing it, at helping people, and to put the right injunctions in place to stop those kinds of situations from happening more.
I think that's incredibly helpful for parents to hear that. And so it is not reflected in the actual practical solution. So injunctions do work. It's just the abuser quite often convinces the victim that they don't, and that's a route to convincing them not to report. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes, that happens a lot. And not just to not report it, or to that injunctions don't work, just that people won't believe them. Often people don't even reach out to their closest relatives and friends to say, this is what's happening to me, because they're told no one will believe you, or this is your fault, or, you know, a number of other ways to stop someone from speaking out when they need that help.
I'd love to get some practical examples of the types of abuse you've mentioned, if you don't mind. Like, when you're talking about financial abuse, what could that look like?
So a number of examples I've seen, when somebody has their salary paid into somebody else's bank account or into a joint account that they don't have access to, or when someone's told how they can spend their money, or when someone doesn't work and they're given almost an allowance that just simply isn't enough to live on, or enough to pay for the children's school, or enough to pay for the children's food and clothes. Financial abuse comes in a lot of different varieties, and a lot of it is down to control. Who is controlling the family finances, and who is controlling how each person spends their money? In particular, you know, your own money. I've seen so many cases where people are expected to pay their money into a joint bank account that they don't have access to, or someone else's bank account, which is shocking to people who aren't in that situation, but it does happen quite a lot.
I think people might be surprised to hear that around this area, you know, it's an affluent area, it's a well-to-do area, and that will probably be a surprise, I think. But I mean, you're telling us that, you know, because you said earlier, you know, it's happening all around us, it's happening to our neighbours and everything. You know, there's no necessarily kind of less need in the local area than there is anywhere.
No, absolutely not. It happens from the most wealthy families to the poorest families, and all kinds of backgrounds. It happens to men and women. It really isn't something that just impacts one group of people. It is really something that can happen to absolutely anyone.
And Helen, could you give us an example of psychological abuse, and just the most common examples you see?
Yeah, we see a lot of gaslighting. That's definitely a phrase that people have heard more of recently. It's coming up in the news a lot, which is where somebody changes the dynamic of the conversation. So they basically tell you that what you're saying is not the truth. You know, something will happen in the house, or they'll move something and they'll say, that wasn't me, I didn't do that. And you know that, you know, for example, your phone has gone missing and you didn't move it, but they convince you that your narrative of the truth is not true. So that's a form of psychological abuse. And there's lots of different varieties. One of them is shutting you off from your friends and family, and telling you that they are your only support network. There's lots of different types of psychological abuse.
That's really helpful and kind of puts it into context. And I think also helps people to understand where the limits are, where the boundaries are, and when actually it's time to do something about it. And it's really interesting, as you were speaking and before you said it, I was thinking, oh, this sounds like just a control issue. And then as you were describing, I was thinking, this sounds just like gaslighting. So they seem to be common denominators when you're talking about abuse.
Yeah, and I think it definitely helps that the conversation around this has opened up recently. It helps that people have even heard of the phrase gaslighting, because before, people just did not recognise psychological abuse in the way that they do now.
And actually, there are so many, you're making so many points that really do clarify the situation. And I think it hadn't occurred to me that, of course, with lockdown, the support network for people who are, victims will also have been cut off. So just if perhaps the partner is going to work, they're now in the house, they can't therefore access their friends. Obviously, they can't go into other people's houses as a safe haven. And actually, there's so many ways where it's been much more difficult than I think I had realized during the lockdown. For you, Helen, what are the greatest challenges as a family lawyer in this area?
I think we've already discussed that one of the issues is that people don't necessarily recognise domestic abuse unless it's violent, physically violent. So I think that is a real issue that we're trying to open this conversation that psychological abuse, financial abuse, they're all types of domestic abuse, and there are injunctions and help available for people. And another thing is that I think that a lot of people really find it difficult to take that first step. If you've been told for so long that what you say is not the truth, or you've been told for so long that nobody's going to believe you, of course that first step is so difficult. And getting someone to the point where they are ready to do something about the abuse that they're suffering is not easy. I've had clients before where it's taken years to get to the point where they're ready to take that step. They'll go through the entire divorce process or Child Act proceedings, and they won't talk about the abuse that they've suffered. And that's really difficult for people to get to that stage where they're ready. I think as well, also recognizing that it happens to anyone. I think a lot of people don't want to be a victim. They don't believe they fall into that category. Men are well known to not want to speak up about domestic abuse, but also people who are intelligent, people who are generally surrounded by people that should have noticed, will say that they don't want to be considered a victim by those people. So I think that's one of the huge obstacles that we face as family solicitors.
I can imagine exactly what you're saying, Helen, that you have strong, resilient people who are the victims of abuse, and they can't reconcile that that reality. So I think it's so helpful what you've said to kind of really shine a light on the other kind of more subtle forms, which are nonetheless still abuse, for anybody listening in, and for us to kind of keep an eye out for friends a little bit more of a keener eye, bearing these techniques in mind.
And neighbours as well. I think that's something that actually has increased, although people's support networks in terms of family has decreased. People have noticed their neighbours being in abusive situations more often because there's only a wall between you all day long. So if there is something happening and you notice it, opening that communication channel with someone that perhaps you don't talk to very often could be a real lifeline for them.
Oh, well, that's just made me think of one a benefit of lockdown. And let's be honest, there's not many. But of course, we have become closer to our neighbours and our local communities because we've formed, so many local WhatsApp groups and communities where people have become aware. And I can speak from my own experience of people that they've perhaps lived, you know, near for 15 years and not necessarily known their name. And then when we know each other more, we can put a name to a face. I suppose we're more likely to be able to reach out to those people if we need help, and recognize perhaps that they're not always seeming to be the way they should be.
Yes, definitely.
For those people, for those victims of domestic abuse, what do you recommend if they are experiencing it and they haven't yet reached out to anybody? What do you think are those first steps that they need to take, Helen?
The first step, if there is physical violence or you are under pressure, you're in immediate danger, then you should always call the police. Although we can help with injunctions, they are the first port of call if you are in danger of someone being physically violent towards you. I think as well, it's really important to get a good support network around you. I know it's really difficult in lockdown, but if you can have that first conversation with someone and just say, this is what's happening to me, this is how I'm feeling, to have someone there to talk to is so important, and someone to help you and encourage you to take the first step to getting the help that you need. That's key. And also speak to an expert, speak to a solicitor, speak to somebody from a helpline that deals with this kind of situation all the time who can explain to you, these are the steps that need to be taken. So it's not so scary when it is the complete unknown. I think if you are aware of what steps need to be taken, that's helpful. And I think as well, just knowing that it's not your fault, just knowing that it's not about you, it's about the perpetrator. It's a form of control that they are doing this to you. And I think people don't like the word victim. So a lot of people try to change the narrative around being a survivor. And I think that can really help people. If they realize that it's not them, they're going to survive this, and they just need that support network around them.
Really, really wise words, Helen. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm sure it'll be a massive help to our listeners as well, both male and female. It really, really enlightening. Thanks so much for joining us on the Parents Show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Tonight we're talking on the Parents Show about sugar, and in particular sugar and children. And what has prompted this was an initiative which was announced from the government a few weeks back, to expand access to weight loss services and even potentially offering people financial rewards for maintaining a healthy lifestyle as part of the fight against obesity. Now, we've seen figures in recent times which suggest that our children are at the forefront of this battle with obesity, and that as many as 1 in 3 children are overweight or obese. And our guest tonight to talk about this is a long-time campaigner and lobbyist with the government on childhood obesity, June O'Sullivan. And I'm delighted to say that June is with us now. June, welcome back to Radio Verulam. I think this is your third or fourth visit to us here. How are you?
I'm fine, and thank you. Gosh, that feels very good, to be honest.
Yes, not many people get back on our show three times, so you're obviously doing something right.
Oh, thank you.
Now, as I said in the introduction, you're a long-time lobbyist to the government on childhood obesity, and you've done a lot of campaigning about this, and you know a lot about it. It is, I guess, a thorny issue. So if I was to say, what's the problem? I think we're going to get a very complicated answer, but I'm going to try it anyway. What is the problem? What is leading to this outbreak, this epidemic of childhood obesity?
Well, I'm going to bounce that right back to you and say it is a complex and complicated subject. And I was very shocked the other day having a conversation with a colleague of mine who's a dance and movement expert, to find that since 1992, there has been 14 different strategies, government strategies on child obesity, and 698 reports. And it's going up, not going down. So I think the first thing to me, the most common sense thing that sort of struck me when I was hearing those kind of statistics, is that clearly we haven't collaborated well enough with all the varying initiatives that have been going on, and too many projects and no real strong central approach to it. And I think that's part of the problem.
Where do the various reports and initiatives start then? Where do they aim? What are they trying to fix with this problem?
I work, as you know, with children under five, and I began to be kind of aware of an increasing image of the sort of obese child. And you don't, you know, like babies can be quite fat and kind of cuddly and almost edible. But generally, children...
That might be the problem.
Well, they are rather gorgeous babies. But, you know, the problem generally that, well, there isn't a problem. What happens then is you see your child stretch and they tend to be pretty skinny because they're running around all over the place, and they kind of have their own sort of kind of management clock. But what we began to notice was more and more of them with both obesity indicators and bad teeth. Two are interconnected, I have to say. And when we observed this, I wondered what that would mean. Now, you know, the big picture stuff is that they end up with asthma, diabetes, cardiovascular illnesses, musculoskeletal problems, etc. But actually, for a little 2 or 3 year old in a nursery, being overweight meant things like they couldn't cross their legs. You know, when they wanted to sit cross-legged, if they chose to, they found it difficult to engage in the usual kind of playful, you know, runabouts that children engage in. They found some of the activities, the planned activities, you know, obstacle courses, hiding, you know, chasing games, running games, you know, planned activities that nursery teachers would organize, they found hard to engage. They got breathless. And we began to wonder also about their sense of self and self-esteem. You know, if you can't do the things that all your friends can do, you begin to feel a little bit different. And that's usually has some kind of impact on how you see yourself. And so I thought, well, maybe it's just one off, you know, maybe it's just a random thing. And I watched and watched and I saw more and more of this across the piece. Now, clearly, we saw more of it in areas where there are greater levels of poverty. And that caused me to start to question what we were doing and what on earth is causing this, you know. And then you begin to unpack the issues, and the issues are processed food, too many snacks, not enough exercise, too much sugar in food that parents don't even know, the cost of food, of decent food, being more expensive, parents relying more on processed foods because they're working longer hours, more car driving, more less walking, more sitting indoors because people have a perceived view that it's unsafe to be outside. So a kind of a whole heap of stuff began to emerge rather than, oh, it's just one thing, which would be easy if it was. And then you had supermarkets advertising what I call the bug-offs. They're usually pretty sugar-induced kind of cheaper foods. And so we began to explore all of this. Had no idea how much sugar is in like a carton of orange juice. And so for some parents, they see the word vitamin C and think, oh, this is good. We'll give them this. This is healthy. And then realize that actually it's quite a lot of sugar in there. One of the things that some parents, I think, found that I was almost draconian about is we serve no fruit juice at all, only milk or water. And I think some parents used to say to me, oh, June, you know, they should have the fruit juice because it's good for them. And I say, no, we're giving them the fruit, but we're not giving them the juice because we don't know what portion of sugar is in some of them. And also the descriptors at the back, you know, if you have the time to read them, are really hard, kind of gobbledygook, really. So you're not really sure what you're hearing.
We should remind our listeners that you are the chief of the London Early Years Foundation, 39 nurseries and preschools across London. So you see a lot of children. And when we spoke before about nursery education, you pointed out that you'd taken an initiative to look at the food that children were eating and to build a training plan for chefs at nurseries and your own laboratories and kitchens.
That's absolutely true. And that's expanding now. I guess just to use a pun here, obesity and child obesity is a bit like an elephant. You know, you can't eat it all at once, and you've got to figure out which bit of it you're going to use. And so I began to wonder what we could do in nurseries in our small bit. What bite of the elephant could we make? So our first attempt was to understand, you know, are we serving the right food? Are we buying stuff that we think is okay and actually perhaps it's not? Are our chefs really well trained enough to make good judgments about food for children? You know, that sort of thing. So we started to ask all those questions, and I was surprised by the outcome. So the answer really was that there is no qualification for chefs working with children. And the second thing was a lot of them just thought what they did, what they thought was all right, but that wasn't guaranteed to be the best nutritional balanced diet for children. And there are organizations out there, Infant Toddler Forum comes to mind, and Sustain Food and School Food Matters, and lots of organizations out there who are trying to kind of give good guidance, you know, chefs in schools, to give good guidance to chefs to help them to choose serve and present to children the right sort of balanced food. But it wasn't guaranteed. So I spent a great deal of my time watching chef programs on the TV and realizing my lack of knowledge about things, but also realizing that nobody out there was spending a great deal of time worrying about how we feed our under fives and their needs being very different. And so it became a bit of an obsession of mine, and that's led to much more work around the child obesity campaigns and for the mayor and various other things. And so we developed a qualification against all the odds, I have to say. Oh, it took me a long time, but I was determined. And then we set up at Leaf the first early years chef academy. And we started to train our own chefs, and we're opening that out to other people's chefs as they show an interest. And we measure various things. So we measure things like waste. Waste is a really good indicator of where children are getting the right balance of food and they don't want it and they don't like it. We were also measuring the fact that quite a lot of food was being served that really was resonant of your sort of middle-aged woman on a diet. So huge mountains of carrot sticks, mountains of hummus. And actually the children needed different things. They needed more carbohydrate in the afternoon. They needed more zinc, but it didn't have to be, you know, any sugary. Our chefs became expert at developing and creating wonderful cakes and scones without any sugar, using vegetables particularly. And we stopped things like the birthday cake kind of industry that was getting more and more, and we're a big organization. I have 4,500 children. Just became a big, huge thing. And so now we create the most glorious sculptures from fruit as the celebration of a child's birthday. And the chefs have become you know, masters of the sculpture, of using the watermelon and, you know, grapes and apples and whatever is available, and it's a real success. So we started in small steps like that, and then started to work with parents to kind of, in a way, inform them. And to be honest, my heart goes out to parents. There's so much contradictory information out there. You know, they can't do right for doing wrong, and they can't do wrong for doing right. And so we wanted to give much clearer ideas and suggestions. So we created some menus and some, you know, cookery advice and stuff. But also that the chefs became much more confident about what they were doing. And so therefore, as a consequence, more able to talk to the parents in a kind of meaningful and helpful way. And the chefs, the parents, of course, see a chef in fancy black and white outfits and nets and, you know, shoes and stuff, and they take them far more seriously than a nursery teacher or a nursery manager. So that was what I call the beginning of a kind of conversation, where then we began to then do more and more research, you know, as to what the bigger issues were.
It's a very, very simple approach that you've taken there, and one which, you know, I remember registering surprise that no other nurseries or early years foundations of any sort were focusing on this sort of area. And that's worked very well for the parents, or for the children, the 4,500 children which you're responsible for. But I know that you also operate on a bigger stage, and you lobby the government and advise the government on childhood obesity and the causes behind that. I know that you also operate on a bigger stage, and you lobby the government and advise the government on childhood obesity and the causes behind that. When you're talking to the government, what sort of issues are you addressing with them?
The main point of this is to say that, you know, if you don't get it right for the early years, you're doomed, basically. You know, by the time a child is five, they're on a pretty poor trajectory if they're already obese. I mean, the pattern of obesity tends to start almost in pregnancy and goes through, and it's very hard to stop it as it starts to become part of the way the child is growing and developing. That's not to say you can't. And also to say there's lots of nurseries trying to do stuff. There's lots of nurseries, you know, on farms. There's now awards for good nursery food. So there are a lot of attempts to try and address some of this stuff in a nursery or indeed childminder or preschool, but there wasn't anything systematic. So, and I think hopefully this will become a systematic way of doing things. So I think when you talk to the government, it's a question of quite often money. So if we invest in giving our children access to good school food, like, you know, the big campaign Marcus Rashford drove there in the summer, where small children don't have access to food vouchers, and the food vouchers you saw were rather scandalous in what they could offer, mm-hmm, and the food that was produced. So if you're saying to the government, look, if you invested properly in the first instance, the cases of obesity are likely to reduce. That means the demand on the NHS for all the sort of long-term illnesses that are kind of emerging as a consequence of this, which at the last count was something like in cost of eight, or, you know, something huge in terms of billions on the NHS, are likely to be reduced. So the early intervention at the early years seems to make sense to me, and to the children and to the families and to society more generally. Also, I say to my staff and to other employers, you want people to grow up healthy. So when they come to you fresh-faced, aged 18, to, you know, to work, you don't want them with asthma or diabetes or some kind of long-term problem, which is the likelihood is going to happen if they're obese from the time they're little. So, you know, as a society generally, we need to take a handle on this and think about the implications for us. Even if we can't imagine what it must be like for a small child, we need to think about what happens when those small children grow up, and they do so quite quickly, and what that kind of means. So I think for the government, they need to understand that a strategy has to be invested in that's actually going to reduce the long-term implications for the health of the nation.
Well, there have been a couple of major initiatives in amongst all of the reports that you referenced earlier on. In 2016, the first stab at childhood obesity reduction attacked sugary drinks with a levy. It took out 20% of sugar from a lot of products. It supported innovation of more healthy products, very much on the sort of manufacturing and the quality of food and drinks and confectionery, which was made available to children. And then 2018, it seemed to change tack a little bit with a review of promotions and two-for-ones and the bog-offs, as you said before. Is that a better approach, do you think, to sort of attack the business strategies behind promoting the bad quality foods to children, or does it actually come down to the availability of snacks and chocolate and sugar for children? Because, you know, we do know that if those things are available, parents are going to feel either guilty or blackmailed into buying them. Where do you think the problem starts?
I think the food manufacturers have a real part to play in this and have a real responsibility. And need to step up a bit more to the plate on this. So shrinking the size of your Cadbury's bar, or, you know, reducing the sugar in the bar, but still selling, you know, them £5 for a pound is not the answer. And there is no reason why they need to add so much sugar to stuff. And there is no reason why they can't rethink the way things are presented and packaged. So I think even before you think about the supermarkets, I think you need to think about the manufacturers of food and their responsibility to society. There's quite a pattern here across the piece on, you know, manufacturers and businesses developing products that actually somebody else has to pick up the price of. So for their immediate profit, we're picking up, you know, £6 to £8 billion cost in the NHS because of the way these things are made and marketed. I mean, I think that marketing is also relevant, but I think it's kind of, you know, touching just the edge because, you know, okay, so that, you know, they won't advertise on the TV during the time that the children are around. But, you know, all of that falls through when you think how many children are on iPads and, you know, all of the access they have to the internet, which is much less sort of filtered regarding adverts. And also in the supermarket, you know, children like cereals, and there's no reason on earth why they have to put so much sugar into cereals that they can't do things and present, you know, cereals that are better for the children, including porridge, you know, shredded wheats, Weetabix, that sort of thing, as the dominant cereal. But, you know, you present all of these things with chocolate and with sugar and with sweets and with marshmallows and stuff, and every child in the land wants to have them.
They're just broken up biscuits, really, when you look at what's in the packet.
Exactly.
Now, the NHS have some guidance for combating childhood obesity. And the first of their recommendations is about being a good role model. And it's no secret that many of us grown-ups could do with a bit more exercise, a bit less sugar, and a bit more toning to how we look. Do you think that children develop their habits in that early stage from observing parents and the sedentary lifestyle which they might lead? Is it, I mean, obviously it's going to be good for us all to get out there, but do you think that's a major contributory factor?
I absolutely do. And I think we have to be a bit honest with ourselves and look in the mirror and actually accept that probably a lot of us could do with losing a stone or so. And I don't think lockdown has helped us, because both stress causes you to eat more, and also just sheer boredom of being in front of a screen all day long means that you punctuate your day with a treat. So I think we have to be honest about some of that stuff. I think in terms of fitness, if you look at the early years foundation stage, and if you look at the national curriculum, fitness isn't a big part to play in this, and actually should have a much bigger part to play in it, in the same way as cooking. You know, for a long time, cooking was food science, which wasn't cooking at all. So a lot of people don't know how to pull things together quite quickly. You know, so they rely on the more processed foods, which are prepared, tasty, easy, and often quite cheap. So I think it's multifaceted how we address that. I mean, one of the things we were doing at Leaf was looking at bicycles. So bicycles are a regular kind of resource in most schools and nurseries. And what we were wondering was, were children using, you know, were children using bicycles? How were they using bicycles? And how were teachers using bicycles to explore children's learning across the piece? And then, were bicycles encouraged, or, you know, suitable as a means of, you know, extending not just the child's ability to ride a bike, but also the family engagement. So, you know, so in a way promoting healthy lifestyle, in a way creating a different kind of cultural sets of behaviours that would lead to maybe better food, better sleep, better better kind of attitudes to health. And so we did a piece of work looking at how we use bicycles and what we've learned about how we might use them better. And we asked parents as well, because we were concerned about things like storage. A lot of parents in London live in flats, you know, bikes are, can take up some space, et cetera, et cetera. So we were interested in that, and we've been doing a piece of research with our parents in 8 of our nurseries across 4 boroughs to really understand how and why cycling and, you know, going to the park as a family on bikes were an issue. Surprisingly, the price of the bike was less of it. But the big things that worried parents were the weather, the roads, and the sense of safety. And so there were the three kind of barriers that were up kind of operating in their minds. So it's very interesting, because I was talking to Cycling UK and Cycling Scotland about this yesterday, about how we take a small thing like, you know, your traditional small bike, and then think about how we might help to create an environment that allows for more, say, cycling. It could be scooting, it could be other things, but actually it begins to use that to rethink your attitude to healthy lifestyle and your attitude to movement and your attitude to going outside. So I think we must start in small ways, you know. If we tell everyone they've got to go to the gym or they've got to be able to do, you know, 10K on a bike, no one's going to do it. But if you start in a small way, and I think if, you know, if we guarantee that every child, say in London and, you know, in Hertfordshire, got an opportunity to be trained to cycle by the time they're 4 or 5, you've kind of created A, a new skill for them, B, there's loads of learning about it, but C, you've given them a kind of sense of confidence and competence that actually will then drive, I think, a kind of that kind of nudge and pressure power that you get from children in the family for them to take them to go out and to go to the park and to go to, you know, wherever you can to sort of cycle. So I think there's like ways nurseries and schools can really encourage and support that sort of change in behavior that then creates a more positive attitude to being active rather than being told all the time you shouldn't be sitting in front of the TV and being finger wagged at, you know, which I think people just don't know what to respond to that and think, well, where, what can I do? Where can I go?
Like you said at the beginning of the interview, we've got to eat this elephant one small bite at a time, and there's lots of different places to start. June, thanks for covering so much ground with us this evening. You've demonstrated the answer to the very first point you made. This is an incredibly complicated subject and many, many facets to consider. And we've covered an awful lot of those here tonight. Thank you, June, for joining us. That's June O'Sullivan.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
And that's it for this episode of The Parent Show here on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. We'll be back at the same time next week on Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Our thanks to our sponsors, Raiden Solicitors, and to our guests this evening, Helen Lafferty and June O'Sullivan.